You are listening to The Coffee Table on KBBI AM 890 Homer. I'm your host, Aaron Bolton, and in the studio with me, I have Homer Representative Paul Seaton joining us this morning. So thanks for joining us, Paul.
Yes, good morning. Glad to be here.
Great. And we will open the lines in just a little bit. And that number, again, is 235-7721. And if you're not able to call, you can always email us at info@kbbi.org. And if you want the toll-free number, that number is 800-979-5224. So we will open the lines in just a little bit. But first, some news coming out earlier this week. The Alaska Republican Party made a vote on Saturday to basically block you and Anchorage Representative Gabriel Ledoux and Representative Louis Stutes of Kodiak from participating in the primaries. And we spoke a little bit yesterday, and you said that you weren't made aware of that vote prior to Saturday's decision.
Oh, that's correct. The only thing I've seen is news reports. We were never personally contacted, never made aware of anything beforehand. So
okay. And it sounds like I spoke with the party chairman yesterday. It sounds like this is kind of the same decision they made last year. Just adding that block to the primaries to as far as what they see as breaking a rule of coxing with the other party.
Well, it's kind of silly, actually, because what they're saying is if you do anything bipartisan, basically, you are going to be excommunicated from the party, or you're not going to be excommunicated from the party, you're just going to be prevented from running in the election, on the primary election. So it's, I thought it was interesting that the Republican Party has taken the Iranian model of democracy, that is, you have an election, but you have some Ayatollah or central committee come up and make the decision of who can be on the ballot for people to vote for. And I've always trusted the voters of this district, and I think that Republicans should be trusting their voters in each individual district to select the candidates they perceive and want.
Okay, and the party is basically saying that they're able to do this because of a recent court ruling in October, which the Democrats actually brought in order to allow independents to run in their primaries. And they're saying that basically allows them to add this consequence, I guess, to that rule that they're speaking about as far as coxing with another party. And so you said yesterday you didn't think that it will comply with state law.
Well, I don't think so. They're quite different things. The primaries, the parties have the ability under the closed primary system, which was, the Republicans sued to close the primary, but they're able to open it to voters in nonpartisan, undeclared, that, they can determine that. And the same with the Democrats. They can have that selection on theirs. And the only difference here was not who could vote in the primary, but who can run in the primary. So in the case of the Democrat, desire and the lawsuit right now was to allow people that were eligible to vote in their primary, if they had a different party affiliation, to also run in the primary. Here we're saying that the party would restrict the Republicans that can run in their primary. So I think it's quite a different idea.
Yeah, and the Division of Elections sounds like they're going to be making their decision within a week. The Republican Party Chair Tuckerman Babcock sent a letter to them late Monday afternoon, the director emailed us yesterday saying basically they'd be making their decision in about a week. And so, if they do decide that they can, in fact, block people from running in their primaries, you said yesterday that you may think about getting signatures to still run as a Republican, just not as the nominee.
That's correct. I mean, we can do that right now. I mean, you saw that when Lisa Murkowski did a write-in for the general election, that's perfectly allowed in state law right now. If you run by the by getting signatures and putting yourself on the ballot that way. It's in the general election. Okay. So,
and do you think that would make it harder to run as a write-in versus being the Republican Party's nominee?
Oh, I don't think so. More than half the state is not affiliated, or about half the state is not affiliated with either party. Those people that vote are the people that vote, and you, when you're in a campaign, you try to talk to everybody. So that's everybody can vote there.
And the main reasoning Republican Party Chairman Babcock gave me yesterday was the party sees you running as a Republican and then joining the House coalition, as they say, it's misleading voters. Do you think that was misleading voters by joining the Democrats and a couple independents?
Oh, absolutely not. When I ran, I said that, we needed to organize in a way that the people that were willing to solve the fiscal problem of the state, and for the previous three elections, we had been, organized strictly, along party lines, and then could add some other people to that. But those people were not willing to address the state's fiscal problem and come up with a comprehensive fiscal solution. So all of the people that were willing to work on a comprehensive fiscal solution joined a coalition. And so this was not the Democrats seeking, Republicans out for partisan reasons. This was organization around trying to solve Alaska's problems, which had been ignored and kicked down the road, as the expression is, kicking the can down the road. And that had been the procedure that had been followed for several years, just draining our savings and moving on and getting a budget passed and not addressing anything. And so, unfortunately, we're somewhat in that same mode right now because the Senate refused to look at diversifying the state's revenues in any way. If you don't diversify your revenues, you're stuck on one track, and if there's anything that happens to that track, then that's a real problem. So and it was a long session last year, longest in history, and then, four special sessions trying to get there, but we just, couldn't get the other side to do it. We passed a comprehensive fiscal plan to the other side, which we thought was the most fair and balanced way of addressing the problem of progressive income tax to balance the reduction in the permanent fund dividend, which is very regressive. In other words, the regressive nature of the reduction of the permanent fund dividend falls hardest on middle income and lower income families and families together versus a progressive income tax, which falls hardest on the highest earners in the state. So a progressive and a regressive balance out to be pretty proportionate all the way across the state. So fairness is what we were looking for, and that's what we passed to the Senate.
Yeah, and we'll get to some of the budget items in just a minute. But the last question on this topic is, if they are allowed to block, have that control over to say who and who can run in a Republican primary, do you think that may deter people in the future from working in these types of bipartisan coalitions or doing some of these kind of bipartisan measures?
Well, I think what it will actually do is have people leave the party, and we'll have them, do exactly what state law allows, and that's run in the general. Their party affiliation would stay their party affiliation if they wanted to, and they would run as a write-in on the ballot, not as a write-in, but as a candidate on the general election. So it does make things more difficult. It does make it so that individual contributions to campaigns are much more important. And so, that'll be a factor in the coming election as well.
And is your plan to stay a Republican if you are blocked from the primaries?
I have no intention at this point to change my affiliation. I've been a Republican since I was 18 years old. I'm a fiscal conservative. What really seems to be happening is the far right wing of the party, and especially the social conservative wing of the party, is trying to eliminate anybody that's a moderate or that's willing to work in a bipartisan manner from the party itself. So you don't even hear the word fiscally conservative mentioned hardly in the Republican Party anymore. So it's a the party is growing itself in one direction only.
All right, and we will open the lines in just about 10 minutes here. And again, that number is 235-7721. You can always email info@kbbi.org. And the toll-free number is 800-979-5224 for those folks across the bay and elsewhere. And so going to the last special session, The one thing that wasn't didn't seem to get touched was Governor Walker's tax proposal. It was a 1.5% what he called a flat tax, which would basically be twice the amount of the permanent fund dividend, and then basically stops at past income earners of $147,000 per year. Why wasn't any action taken on the proposal?
Well, unfortunately, you know, it was supposed to be looking at new revenue, the special session, and then the governor added on the crime bill. And, I understand why he did. There was a lot of social media problems, crime rates in Anchorage. Some things need to be addressed. Some had been addressed already. But once you put that on the agenda, we had had on SB 91, we had 4 days of continuous debate. We had almost 50 hours of debate on the House floor on 91. And so we knew once that got added on, it was going to control the entire conversation. And it also gave the Senate the ability to just ignore the revenue picture, because they have wanted to ignore that all the way. So anyway, that's kind of where we went. The House Finance Committee had two hearings as well as background hearings on the revenue measure. We outlined three different amendments that would be necessary to even consider that bill. But we've already passed to the Senate what we thought was the most fair, equitable, comprehensive, sustainable fiscal plan to the Senate. So it's up to them, if they want an alternate, to pass some alternate back to us. And so, we had those hearings. We put on the floor of the Finance Committee the amendments that we thought would remove the cap, because it's regressive if high-income people are paying a less percentage than low-income people when you're calling it a flat tax, because it was capped at basically $147,000, and everything above that was no tax. So the percentage goes lower and lower compared to total income. And, so we were looking at that. We were looking at also if there was going to be a bond passed, a general obligation bond. One of the other amendments was looking at having it so that the citizens, when they voted, would already know, just like they do in the general obligation bonds in boroughs, they'd know what the tax rate would be and to that small increase and when it would go away. So that's a problem with a general obligation now, is there's no method of payment. So it's just, okay, future legislatures, we're going to spend this money now, and you're going to be having to figure out how to raise that money to pay back those bonds. And so we're trying to get through a few of those things.
Okay. And you mentioned two. What was the third amendment?
The third was to change, just to clarify, that the corporate tax applied to sub-S corporations as well. Right now we have the fourth largest oil company in the state, which is a sub-S corporation. So all of its profits flow through to members as an individual, and since there's no individual income tax, there's no tax paid at all. So you have this differential between oil companies that pay their corporate income tax and people that can avoid corporate income tax by declaring Chapter S corporation status. And this wouldn't have changed their federal status. It would have just said that, hey, for the purposes of corporate income tax in the state of Alaska, you have to pay it, no matter whether you're a sub S corporation or a regular corporation.
That would basically make this 1.5% apply to those incomes for the S corporations then.
It just meant that they would have to file corporate income tax instead of no income tax.
Okay. And so this went through the House committee, but it never made it to the House floor.
Well, it was brought up and we had two hearings on it to look at the issues, but we didn't pass anything out House Finance. We didn't adopt amendments and anything, but we were saying if this is going to come from the Senate, these are the things we'd like you to consider so they could pass those things ahead of time and then we would be more in agreement with them. So just putting on the table the items that could be in dispute from the original bill that was introduced by the governor.
And this may be taken up in the next regular session. I mean, what are the chances that the House Finance Committee would put something to the House next session?
We've already put forward, and it's still on the table, a comprehensive fiscal plan that we sent to the Senate, and they could ask for that back, and we'll give it to them. We have not said that, okay, you didn't like that one, we'll generate another one. If you don't like that, we'll generate something else. We're not just into passing a tax. We want a fair and equitable solution for Alaska's problem. And we think we've proposed that. We're willing to consider modifications that they would make if they want to get rid of the top rate, you know, 7% rate. If they want to have other amendments, we'd be perfectly happy to consider those. But their finance committee took the bill and just said, we're not interested in any diversification of our revenue. We're passing this to the floor just to vote against it. And so really revenues, I believe, are off the table entirely. The Senate is, you know, has a line of saying we don't need new revenues. That's it.
Okay, and I just want to remind people, they can call. We'll open the lines now. We have Representative Paul Seaton in the studio with us. So if you have a question for Paul, you can call 235-7721, or you can email info@kbbi.org. And the toll-free number is 800-979-5224. And so, you know, going back to revenue, The big sticking point last year seemed to be the income tax. Both the Senate and House passed different versions of bills that would basically use permanent fund earnings to help fund state government. But the Senate didn't like the income tax portion of the bill. Do you think that there's a chance that the House may agree to just pass that first, or is the income tax still firmly a part of that plan?
Well, we think that you need a comprehensive and sustainable plan, and we don't think that a permanent fund only or permanent fund only plus permanent fund dividend reductions plan is a plan that's good for the state of Alaska. You know, the big problem that we see is that it takes a year and a half to implement any kind of new tax. By the time you get regulations and all those kind of things, get a method of withholding, get whether it's a sales tax, whether it's a income tax, it all takes about that long to get in. And so if you don't start addressing the problem now, you're talking about 2 years down the line before there's any money. I don't think that the House is considering that. There were two elements in there. One was a change in the tax rate on oil, and the other one was a comprehensive fiscal plan. You know, and we had our four-pillar plan that was there, but oil tax was part of that. And so the Senate did not address that either. We did work on the credit portion, And so that was good. But as far as raising any new revenues, zero consideration there. So both of those elements probably are necessary to for us to get a sustainable budget in the state of Alaska. We just have to diversify our revenues. We're the only state in the entire United States that doesn't have either a sales tax or an income tax, and about 40 states have both. Right now, you know, residents pay no income tax to the state, they pay no property tax to the state, and they pay no sales tax to the state. So there are no state taxes, basically. I mean, there's a 8 cents per gallon, lowest in the nation, fuel tax, but that wasn't there. There was a proposal by the administration to increase that 8 cents a year for the next 2 years. But at this point in time, we don't have any diversification of revenue from the Senate.
Okay, and we have a caller. We got Louie on line one. Louie, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yep. Good to go. What's your question?
Hi, this is Louie Flora. I think, Paul, I think you're doing a great job. I'm obviously biased. I worked for you for 10 years. I'm just curious on the new party ruling. I haven't read the exact language of it, but would it take, I mean, a number of the state Senate currently caucuses with Democrats, and historically the House Republican majority has caucused with Democrats for decades, and so I'm just wondering, you know, does this apply to the state Senate right now? Or, I mean, how did they tailor the rule specifically to target, you know, the three Republicans, or how would this work in the future? Is it going to essentially diminish the ability of future coalitions to, you know, caucus in a bipartisan manner? It seems like that would drastically shrink the power of the Republican Party, and as they've used Democrats historically to build their majorities. So I'm just wondering, you know, what your thoughts are.
Hardy, thanks, Lee.
Well, thanks, Louie. As I understand it, it is Republicans saying that if you can't be part of a bipartisan coalition, if there's either a Democratic Speaker of the House or a Democratic President of the Senate, then that would be the case. It happens to be that there's a Republican Senate President, so then that's all okay. That's my understanding of what they are. Like I say, I haven't been contacted or been given anything as to the exact wording. But yes, I mean, the whole object, I think, is to reduce bipartisanship and to, you know, if you had a even split, you probably couldn't be in a bipartisan coalition if there was a Democrat chosen to be a leader. Now, you have to realize that all three Republicans are in leadership. There's seven members in leadership, and there's three of us. I'm the co-chair of House Finance for the operating budget. You have Gabrielle Ledoux, who is the rules chairman, and Louise Stutes, who is a majority whip. So we're all in leadership, but I don't know how they're quite defining that, whether it's that the speaker himself, great speaker, you know, real mild and can work with everybody in the House. So that's, you know,
good. Yeah, I spoke with Tuckerman Babcock, the Republican Party chair, yesterday, and basically how he explained it was if there is a Republican majority, and then the rule would be that Republicans would not be able to caucus with Democrats, and that was the way that it was explained to me. It looks like we have another caller on. Oh, no, we don't. And so basically, that I think that's how it was explained to me yesterday. I guess we'll have to see what the state decides on that.
Well, and I think, you know, just so everybody's clear, the Republican people in the Republican Central Committee, for a long time, there's been a number that wanted to get away from an open primary, first of all, and so there was a lawsuit, and there went to a closed primary so that they could select which voters could be in their primary. And then there's also a move there to not have a primary at all, but to put forward their candidates by caucus, and whether that would be the 65 people in the state central committee would have a list and say, these are our candidates, but there wouldn't be any primaries. And that kind of happens right now with the straw poll that happens. But it wouldn't need to be a straw poll. They could actually legally caucus and say, we're a party that has over 3% of the vote, and we are going to put forward the names of our people in each district that are going to run and bypass the Republican voters' choice for the members in their district entirely. And that's been on the table and been talked about. Again, it depends on what model of voting democracies you want to follow.
Yeah, and getting back to the budget before Louis called, you're basically explaining that the House is really wanting to continue forward with the income tax plan and using permanent fund earnings to pay for state government. It would be good to maybe explain what the House's plan is as far as the permanent fund earnings. It sounds like the Senate and the House's plan to use the permanent fund to help pay for state government is slightly different.
Sure, and ours did not cut the permanent fund dividend as much. We had a $1,250 minimum tax. 33% of the amount of the draw from the earnings reserve would go to dividends. The Senate has only 25%, so they're about a $1,000 dividend, and ours is 33%. So it makes a difference in people's pocketbooks, but what we wanted to do is make sure we weren't only relying on reducing the permanent fund dividend as a source of state funding. Some in the Senate really want to get rid of the dividend entirely, and without having some other diversification of revenue, what it means is if you are shorted money, then the only thing that you can do is basically go to reducing the permanent fund dividend further. And so we are opposed to that. We want to see something that's balanced and fair to Alaskans. We think that the dividend is an integral part of our economy in the state, and also is one of the reasons why we have the lowest disparity between incomes in all of the states. So that's a big factor in that, is making sure that things are balanced and fair.
And during the last special session, there were a few Republican members that felt that because of a recent jump in oil prices, that it was best to hold off on any revenue measures. It sounds like the oil is forecast to be about $55 per barrel to about $60 over the next 5 years. Do you have any hope that oil revenue is going to come back at all, or do you think that forecast is fairly solid?
Well, internationally, there's a fairly smaller range. You know, it's somewhere between $50 and $65. The problem is that the word you use is exactly what our opposition with the Senate is. They say hope. Let's hope that oil prices go higher. Let's hope that we keep getting this even return on our investments. I mean, people know what investments do. They go up and down, and there's no accounting for investment returns going down in what's been proposed by the Senate or the House minority. It's just hope and pray and drain our savings. And, you know, it takes a long time to get anything through that'll stabilize your economy if you are a one-horse show, or even two. I mean, we have investment earnings, but those are really volatile. And we think oil prices are volatile. I mean, if you take the projected amounts and then apply our last history, our last 8 years of history, you see that the volatility is. We've had returns of 1.6%. in the last 5 years, and then 12%. But what that does to the permanent fund earnings reserve can be tremendous, because the earnings reserve gets all of the profits and all of the losses of the entire permanent fund. So instead of like having $10 billion and having 10% loss, you lost $1 billion. If you had a $60 billion fund and the earnings reserve has $10 billion in it, and then you have a 10% change in profits and loss, all of a sudden you've lost $6 billion. You know, and you can do, as we've seen in 2008, 2009, you can do that almost overnight. So counting on everything being stable and perfect for years to come is a strategy that is fraught with danger.
And I just want to remind our listeners again, you can, if you have a question for Paul, you can give us a call at 235-7721. The toll-free number is 800-979-5224, and you can always email us at info@kbbi.org. And so the earnings reserve for the permanent fund, is that the second, basically the second piggy bank, for lack of a better term, or savings account for the state to use after the constitutional budget reserve?
Yeah, and the constitutional budget reserve, you have to realize, only will have at the end of this of 2018 $2.1 billion in it, and our deficit is about $2.7 billion. So you can't even fund it, even if you wiped it out. You still need to take money from somewhere else. And that other, only other else that you have is the earnings reserve of the permanent fund. Now, we can spend that with a 21 and 11 vote, 21 in the House and 11 there. We've always been able to spend some of that money. But it's been critical. We have in the past inflation-proofed the principal. Unfortunately, we're not doing that in these last couple of years, and the reason is because when you don't have income, you better not be tying up all the available cash. Now, there are some other programs available. You know, there's money in the PCE fund. That's the balance of electrical energy or energy costs across the state. And that came from a fund that was had the money put in when it was a whole lot of money being spent on the four dam pool and all for urban Alaska, and that was the balance for power cost equalization for rural Alaska. And so some people are wanting to say, well, we've got the dams, let's get rid of PCE and take that money. And that's possible. Is that fair? I mean, was that the deal that was made? We are basically subsidizing electricity in the rail belt with the four dam pool and all those things. It's not just a rail belt. It's, you know, but Bradley Lake over here was part of that. So we have a some kind of an obligation there. We also established the higher education fund, which pays for the Alaska Performance Scholarships and need-based scholarships. I mean, what we it's been the most effective thing that the state has ever done to increase education in the state. Those need those merit-based scholarships lets kids know in eighth grade, seventh grade, hey, if you take harder classes, prepare. If you do well in school, you can get a scholarship to go through your 4 years of college or a certificate. If you want to go into the workforce, it requires a certificate instead of college. And so it's been the most successful program. I mean, you hear what's happening on graduation rates across the state. They've been great in our district. They have been super great. So anyway, I really commend the education system. A part of that was actions by the legislature to do the performance-based scholarship. And that was a critical portion. So some people want to get rid of that. There'd been a senator that put in a bill to take away that fund and just terminate the program with the kids that are in it now and nobody else in the future. So we don't think that that's a good idea, but we will be looking at everybody's philosophy and everybody's priorities.
All right, and we got another caller on line one. Kevin, you're on the coffee table.
Good morning. I've been listening carefully to what you've said, and it's not exactly the most bright and rosy picture given the current state of affairs. Could you please comment on your opinion on whether the legislature's structure, especially around conflict of interest, where we have a good majority of people who work for the oil companies or related, who are making the decisions whether or not to tax them appropriately or not, or developing tax policy as a source of revenue. Do you believe, in your opinion, that we will ever see that conflict of interest tightened up to get a fair shake? I'll take your response offline.
Well, thanks for the call, Kevin. And what we're talking about, I think, is the fact that we have a citizen legislature who are elected by their districts, and they go down to work on policies and votes. And the way it is structured right now is if a vote comes up and somebody has to abstain because they have a conflict of interest or a potential conflict of interest, if any member objects, they're required to vote. And so this has positives and negatives. The negative is if somebody really has a conflict of interest, that they are personally going to profit or get a contract or something like that, then, you know, that is a definite conflict of interest. If somebody philosophically is aligned with something, that doesn't mean it's a declared conflict of interest. The problem is that we're all down there representing 17,000 people in the House or 34,000 in the Senate. And if we would say, okay, Paul, this is a fishing issue, so Paul has a tender, and so he's somehow involved with fishing, therefore he can't vote on any fishing issues. That means that all of the fishing industry and all of the fishermen in my district would not have any representation in designing the policies and voting on those. And so that's problematic because we are representing people. Now, the conflicts of interest, I believe, should be more clearly delineated. And the person who objects should, you know, also be identified as an objector instead of just a voice somewhere in the crowd. So I think it needs to be tightened up, but I think we have to be very leery about taking away the constituents' rights to have their opinions satisfied.
And we have another caller on the line. Mary, you're on the coffee table.
Good morning, Representative Seaton.
Good morning, Mary.
All I want to say is I think the Republican Party wants to destroy itself, what we're going through nationally, and then to come out with something like this is certainly ridiculous. And there's a newcomer that I was speaking to, and he said, you know, the Alaskans like to say they're independent and can think for themselves. I mean, yes, Babcock just made his point. And so I just want to thank you, Senator. And, you know, it's not only your district who came out full force. I mean, they must be blind not to see what's happening. And but your station, statewide, you have great respect. So I would say they need a new person in representing the Republican Party in the state. That's all.
All righty. Thanks for your call, Mary. Do you have any response to that, or we also have another caller on the line?
Well, just thanks for the call, Mary. But, you know, I mean, I do try and represent all my constituents, and I have lots of, you know, town halls. I do a weekly email newsletter. If you're not getting that, just call the office. And that's not during the interim. That's during the session so that everybody can be aware of what's coming up. It's not just a bunch of pictures. It's, you know, talking about the issues that are on the plate that time. So if people want to be on the newsletter list, you can just email me, rep.paul.seaton@akleg.gov. and we'll put you on that list. You can always unsubscribe later if you want to. But thanks.
And we have another caller on line one. Taz, you're on the coffee table.
Yeah, good morning. First of all, thank you, Paul, for all the good work that you continue to do in our state legislature. You're a fighter in there, and I really appreciate it. And you've been speaking with some great clarity about our need to diversify our income so we can run our state. I'm curious to know if the legislature is talking about or considering any policy about an even more fundamental issue relating to our physical policy in terms of diversifying our state economy, which, of course, will directly relate to our state income eventually. So I'll take your answer offline. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Taz, on that. Diversifying our state economy is a really hard nut to crack. I mean, part of the big complaints about Alaska and the legislature has been we've tried to do that in the past, driving that from the legislature, whether it's the grain terminals in Valdez and the agricultural land in Mat-Su. We've had a fish plant in Anchorage. There's just been a number of different things we've tried to do to diversify that economy, and it's just really hard to do. I mean, you have timber is at dang near a all-time low price, and if we have timber sales to try and keep businesses going, but we are responsible for doing some of the roads to that timber, all of a sudden your cost of the surveying and cost of the roads exceeds the cost that you get for the stumpage on the timber. So it's very difficult, to diversify your economy. There's the Kenai Peninsula has, I think it's on the 10th of next month, the Economic Development Conference. It's going to be up in at Soldotna at the large venue there. And, that's a kind of private sector, public sector. The those economic development districts are really valuable. But most of that diversification has to be done at a smaller local level, because every time people get into it on a mega level, we seem to have mega projects that we don't have a very good track record of success with.
And before Taz's calls or the series of calls, we were talking about kind of what are the options and kind of what is the path forward. So next session, you mentioned that the Constitutional Budget Reserve does not have enough money to fill the budget gap, and there are some other pots of money the state could pull from, but is this the year that something in general needs to happen, whether that be cuts or a tax of some kind or even pulling from permanent fund earnings?
Well, yes, and last year, of course, we had a proposal that would have worked on the permanent fund earning reserve. Would have been 5.25%, the same thing that the Senate has. A little difference in the distribution of the 25% or 33% goes to there. So, that may be going on, but I don't see a bill going through that requires that to be done, that mandates that every year, every legislature do that. We want a sustained draw, and as long as we live within that draw, because we know that 5.25% is a little high, but 5% is okay. And we're looking at the percent of market value of the first 5 years of the last six. And so that means that since the permanent fund is growing, you're actually less than 5% of the fund. And that's considered sustainable throughout, endowments all over the, all around the country. So I think we can get there. We're going to have a tough time because we haven't diversified revenue. We're going to need some more. We do have two things on there. One was a broad-based tax, and the other was changing the oil taxes somewhat. And so that's another possibility. It may be that the Senate rejects that as well. They when we talked, when we did the oil bill, they were only at that point in time interested in working on the credits. And we did that, and we got through there. It wasn't exactly the way we wanted it, but these are compromises. But the portion of the tax got totally ignored, and we may need to revisit that. Because right now the minimum tax on oil is just not very substantial. But you can't go through and change the whole tax regime. I mean, we do have consultants on board now and all. But if we were going to do something, I would presume it would be something simple, just like leaving the system in place but changing a tax rate.
And what is the current tax rate, the minimum tax rate on oil?
4%.
Okay. And so what would be something the you or the House might be looking at?
Well, I mean, from my own standpoint, you know, if we went to 6 or 7% as a gross tax, all I would mean would be before you got into the profits tax, you would be about where we were a couple of years ago at about $74, $75 a barrel. And if the price got above that, then you would be into the profits section.
And so that basically would lower the price of per barrel of oil that we would need in order to balance the budget? Or is that what you're saying? It'd go down from about roughly $90 per barrel, what we'd need to balance budget now, to down to about 70 if we went up to that 6 or 7%?
Well, it would mean that what would happen was we'd be getting more money at when the prices are lower. We're just not, I mean, we're getting $2 a barrel, I think, at a tax at $60. I mean, we get our royalty, but that's our ownership share. But as far as the way the calculation goes with all the credits and everything else, we get very little tax, you know, right now. And so the minimum tax, you know, calculation on a profit base. Mm-hmm. So the minimum tax is the thing that would be helpful. And one of the changes we made in the credits last year was we got rid of credits, because credits could be carried forward and reduce your tax to zero. And rolling forward your expenses, those can only take it down to the minimum tax. And so that's a way in which we improved the system last time.
And we have just about 10 minutes left. If there's anyone that wants to make a last-minute call here, again, the line is 235-7721. The toll-free number is 800-979-5224, or you can email us at info@kbbi.org. And, you know, in just a last little bit on the budget issue, since a lot of Senate Republicans have called for some budget cuts as a way to help close the gap, you know, is it possible with a mixture of permanent fund earnings and cuts to help close that?
Well, sure. I mean, cuts, we've cut about 44% of the budget since 2015. Or 14, and the you know, almost most of that is out of the capital budget, but about 26%, 27% is a reduction in the operating budget. Actual number of personnel that are no longer employed by the state. It was 23, I think. It's like 2,700 people are no longer there in the state. Positions are gone as well. And that wasn't vacant positions, that was actual people were on the ground. And we've seen it, and those cuts a bit have hurt. I mean, we reduced the number of prosecutors so much that 7,000 cases aren't going forward each year. I mean, they have to, it's triage. So we're trying to add back some prosecutors now. Same thing with troopers, trooper post closings. So those kind of things. You know, there hasn't been increases to the K-12 system now for a couple years. I'm hopeful that what we can do is early fund education this year and be the same as we were last year, but at least that would avoid all these pink slips and termination notices for all the non-tenured teachers. We lose a lot of good people because they can't wait around to see if they have a job, and they take a job somewhere else. So I think that we've got we're gaining towards agreement with the Senate and the House and the House minority that, you know, it's constitutional duty to have an adequate education, our 18 level, we believe that that's where we are. And so if we could pass just a appropriation bill with just the education ports of the base student allocation, the boarding schools and Mount Edgecombe, that would allow all of those entities to know what teachers they can retain and go forward. It doesn't mean it's an increase, but at least it would be security. And so we're hoping that we can get there. And but do realize that there is going to be a draw. Mm-hmm. We just hope that that draw can be maintained at no more than the amount that is calculated under the formula.
Okay. And we have just a few minutes left. We have a last caller here. Pat, you're on the coffee table. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning, Representative Seaton. Thank you very much for your service to our community. My question is somewhat based on what you were just discussing, and that is education. So my question is, have you or the other representatives looked at the impacts of the possible passage of the current tax bill, particularly in regards to its impact on higher education, but also on small business owners, healthcare? Have you discuss this, and also, if you have an opportunity to meet with Senators Murkowski, Sullivan, and Representative Young, please let them know that your constituents and their constituents oppose this tax bill, and I'll take your answer off the line. Thank you.
Well, thanks for the question, and we haven't been able to actually analyze the tax bill because, you know, we really don't have one yet. I mean, we can't tell what all those details are until we know them. We know there are impacts there. I've communicated with them the value of the Medicaid expansion that we have in the state. You know, all those people that were previously uninsured going into emergency rooms, some of those costs are coming down, you know, as well as people, if they're healthy, they can get a job, they can work. If they're unhealthy, it's hard to get hired, it's hard to support a family, it's hard to support yourself. So there's a lot of things there that are necessary. I can't tell you what that bill is going to look like when it comes out. So, but we are very concerned about it. We're looking at it. We'll be continuing to comment to the senators and Representative Young as it goes forward. But we really don't have very much input on, or we don't determine very much on that.
Okay, and we have just about 4 minutes left. And just real quickly, outside of the budget issue, what are some other big things coming up next session?
Well, I think the budget issue is probably the biggest one. And I think this education package to get done early in the session as a separate bill, so it's not all tied up in with the entire budget, because there's just really no possibility of doing a $5 billion budget in a way which does it the citizens do and make sure that we are constraining government as much as we can and spending money in the most wise way in a rush. I mean, we don't want to, when you do things in a rush, you can make mistakes. So the one thing about the question that was asked earlier was also about cuts. And you have to realize that half of the budget that we do, 46% of it, comes through down to other communities or schools and those things. It's pass-through money to other entities. And so like the Kenai Peninsula Borough gets about $170 million in Medicaid funding, gets, you know, $53 million of the PFD comes here, unemployment benefits, $10.6 million, adult public assistance, $5.3 million, disability and health gains, about $4.5 million. So senior benefits, $2.2 million, Community Assistance 2.1. So all of that money comes down through the communities. So when you're talking about cuts, you have to go to places where there is money available, and some of that is like in bond debt reimbursement. So if we make those cuts, that means that gets passed on to the voters at a local area. So those cuts become very difficult.
Okay. And is there anything else you'd like to address before we send it over to Bullseye with Jesse Thorne?
Well, just thank everybody. And my email address, again, is rep.paul.seaton@akleg.gov. And be happy to talk with people about local issues on the Lower Kenai Peninsula here.
All righty. Well, you have been listening to The Coffee Table here on KBBI, AM 890 Homer. And we are joined today by Homer Representative Paul Seaton.